Alcoholics Anonymous was founded by two men, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. Both men were alcoholics and found that they could stop drinking if they did it together. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The story of the founding of AA is told in the play Bill W. and Dr. Bob, now playing at the Des Moines Civic Center. Today we'll talk about the history of AA and other treatment options available for alcoholics and others with substance abuse problems. Two members of the recovery community in Des Moines will be here. David Kapton is the program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center, and my other guest, who chooses simply to go by his first name, Bob, is a member of the 12-step community. He'll share his experiences on the path to recovery. We'd like to hear your stories as well. 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after this news. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded in 1935 by two men, Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith. The story of that founding is told in the play Bill W. and Dr. Bob.
I got a few suggestions. Take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth. Just sit and listen. Do what each of us does. Don't drink. Ask for help.
That's a moment from a performance of the play Bill W. and Dr. Bob, now playing at the Des Moines Civic Center through September 26th. My guests today were instrumental in bringing that play to Iowa. David Kapton is the program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center, and my other guest, who chooses simply to go by his first name, Bob, is a member of the 12-step community. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good morning, Charity.
David, why did you think it was so important to bring this play to Des Moines?
Well, I first saw this play about a year ago in October and was just immediately impressed by how well they handled the complex problem of alcoholism and how it really affects an individual's life and then the lives of the families around them. And being in the field of chemical dependency treatment and aware of the large AA community, 12-step community that's in Des Moines, it made sense to begin thinking about, well, how can we get this just excellent play down here to Des Moines?
Do you feel like that's a story that doesn't get told enough today, that alcoholism can really hurt people and destroy families?
Yeah, I think the kind of the nitty-gritty of it doesn't get out there enough. It's something that is it's often a hidden problem. It's one that people don't like to speak about. It's that proverbial elephant in the living room type of thing. And having a venue to be able to portray the way that this thing destroys families is good for the overall view of why it's so important that people receive treatment and get into groups of social support that will help them stay sober.
How big is the problem of alcoholism in the United States?
It's huge. It's the single most destructive addiction that faces our country today. It accounts for billions of dollars worth of lost productivity, healthcare costs. There's some of the best estimates say that it costs our country $683 per person, man, women, and children, and across the whole country. So that amounts to about $210 billion a year. It's unreal. And when you think about that compared to the other addictions that tend to get more media attention or press, it by far outstrips any of those in terms of the overall costs.
Bob, you are a member of the 12-step community, and you're well-versed in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell us a little bit about this story. Bill W. and Dr. Bob were the founders. How did they get together?
Yeah, I got to tell you, I really appreciated it, getting a chance to go to the play at the Civic Center. Anyone who's listening who has a chance to get to that, it's a great portrayal of the history of AA and the start of it. They did a nice job kind of going back to the beginning of Bill Wilson, who was a stockbroker from New York. We call him a stockbroker today. He was really kind of a stock analyst, and he was having his problems with drinking in the early 1930s, and through the fortune of his brother-in-law, landed in the town's hospital in 1933. And he was lucky enough to come in contact with a doctor Dr. Silkworth at the time, who gave him some information he did not know. This doctor gave him what he called a theory that people like him were suffering from an illness. And that Dr. Silkworth was one of the first people to describe alcoholism as an illness in the 1930s. He'd been working in the hospital for about 3 years. It was a hospital of the elite, where people from all over the country at that time were coming for kind of a secluded treatment for drugs and alcohol, the Barrymores and a lot of them. And he told Bill Wilson that he felt he wasn't a weak-willed person or a person that didn't have any character. He just felt he was suffering from an illness, that it was an illness that was twofold. One, that he had a body that he had what the doctor described as an allergy to alcohol. And that meant then whatever, for some reason, he had, as he listened to thousands of alcoholics, this doctor, he had surmised that all of them had one thing in common. That was when they started drinking, that they eventually could not predict when they'd accurately stop. Once they started, it seemed to produce a craving for more alcohol once they started. And he kind of got Bill's attention with that. He also told Bill that while this craving would condemn him to keep drinking once he started, that that was only part of the problem, because we can't stay drunk all the time. And originally, or eventually, people would quit drinking and be remorseful over what happened, and maybe, like Bill had done, promised his wife hundreds of times to quit or stay on the wagon at that time. But he told Bill that he was also suffering from a kind of a mental illness, an obsession of the mind, and that for some reason that feeling that alcohol gave him would always be more important than the promises he had made the consequences of his drinking, that eventually his mind would tell him to start drinking again. And so Bill left that hospital in 1933 with a couple of important pieces of information. And for a while, that knowledge kept him sober. But he started drinking again, and in the summer of 1934 ended up back in the hospital again. And this time the doctor pronounced him incurable and said that he would probably have to be locked up or go insane, and told his wife that she might just expect him to end up a wet brain someday. And that just really scared Bill. And he left the hospital, and the fear sobered him up for a while. But he drank again a couple months later and ended up back in the hospital in December, which would end up being his last time in the hospital. He didn't know it, but he was visited by an old friend, a friend that he used to drink with, who had a bad drinking problem. In fact, Bill used to say, if I ever get as bad as my friend Ebby, I'll quit. And his friend Ebby visited him and was 60 days sober. And told Bill, hey, Bill, it doesn't have to be that way anymore. I ran into a group of people who have helped me do some things which have helped me stay sober. And he brought Bill two other important pieces of information. One, that recovery or his sobriety would depend on conscious contact with a power greater than himself. And that this group that Ebby was attending, called the Oxford Group, had a little program of recovery that would take some certain actions to bring about that. And Ebby helped Bill do that there in the hospital, and Bill had what he always called a vital spiritual experience, had kind of a bright light experience. And Bill left the hospital and had decided to sober up all the drunks in New York City and ran around dragging people out of bars and off bar stools and tried to tell them about his bright light experience. And nobody stayed sober. And Bill was frustrated a couple months later and went back to the doctor at Towns Hospital and said, my goodness, it's not working for me. I can't get anybody to stay sober. And the doctor said, you know, maybe you're trying to tell them too much about this big bright light conversion experience you had. Why don't you tell them a little bit about the medical facts I gave you? And so Bill left the hospital with what he hoped would be a new approach to trying to help other people with the problem he had. He ended up in Akron, Ohio, about a month later, trying to work on a proxy fight for a rubber company there. And the proxy fight went south, and he was broke and in the hotel, had no money in his pocket, and was starting to think about in the Mayflower Hotel there about going into the bar and relieving his problems. And he'd remembered that when he tried to help those other drunks, he was able to stay away from a drink. So he made some phone calls and they put him in contact with Dr. Bob, who would be our other co-founder. And they ended up getting together. On June 10th of 1935, Dr. Bob took what would be his last drink, and we consider that the start of AA.
You mentioned the Oxford group that had a treatment program. Why didn't Bill stay and work with that group? Why did he feel like he needed to found his own group?
Well, you know, the Oxford group, they were really an interesting group. They were really mostly interested in the people I would call the down and uppers. Bill and his group were a bunch of down and outers. And the Oxford group was really kind of interested in the important people in the community, and they were always encouraging their members to get people who were in trouble with different addictions and especially the well-to-do. And Bill was always bringing drunks back to the group, and they'd come in drunk and he'd try to take care of them. They ended up calling them the drunk squads of the Oxford group. And the Oxford group was always trying to get them to practice some of their religious tenets. They were kind of practicing first century Christianity, and most of the alcoholics didn't want any of that at all. So eventually, to get their focus more around helping drunks, they decided to break from the Oxford group.
Tell me what the basic tenets were and are of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it stayed pretty steady throughout the decades.
Yeah, AA really kind of adopted at that time what Bill's friend Ebby brought to him was an idea of clearing his conscience, admitting he was powerless over alcohol, making restitution for his harms, and then helping other people. That was kind of a basic tenet. The Oxford group had like 150 tenets, many of them, again, with Christian origin, prayer, meditation, and things like that. And so when Bill eventually, later on, when Dr. Bob and Bill, Bill lived in New York and Dr. Bob lived in Akron, when they got back together in 1937, a couple years after it started, they counted heads and found they had 40 people staying sober, and they felt they needed to, you know, it wasn't moving very quickly. So they decided to go ahead and write a book that would contain what they felt was working, because up until that point, it was turned out the message was becoming kind of diluted. And when they wrote the book, Bill would tell later when he wrote the chapter that contains the 12 steps, he never had a reason to use 12. It was no significance to that. That's just what he ended up when he numbered them. And so he wrote the 12 steps, which have by themselves, I'd say divinely inspired probably through him. He was not a great writer. Have helped change as many lives as anything perhaps in the history of the world.
We will talk more about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and alcoholism, other treatment programs for alcoholism in a moment. My guests are Bob and also David Captain, who is the program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center in Des Moines. We'd love to have you join the conversation as well with your thoughts and your stories. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about alcoholism and treatment options for alcoholism and other addictions. My guests today are David Captain, the program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center, and also Bob, who chooses to go just by his first name today. He's a member of the 12-step community, and we'd love to hear from you as well. We've been talking a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to talk about some other treatment options as we go along. What kind of experience have you had? If you've had a problem with drinking in the past and you've gone through treatment programs, what has worked for you or what hasn't worked for you? Alcoholics Anonymous is not for everyone. We'd love to hear your stories. 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, and you can send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. David, when we were talking about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the beginning, one of the big things that made a difference for Bill W. was that a doctor told him that alcoholism is a disease. Do you believe that it's really important to define alcoholism as a disease?
Yeah, I do. There's so much great research out there, especially in the last 10, 15 years that has come out regarding brain changes that happen because of heavy alcohol or drug use. Just the really that the research has centered on a couple of different things that are related to addictions is that there's brain changes, specific ones that occur because of heavy drinking or using, and then the genetics that goes into creating a greater predisposition for one to become an alcoholic or an addict. So there's this great scientific evidence that shows that it is a disease.
It also must be a big emotional step for someone to change their thinking from this is all my fault to wait a minute, I have a disease and I'm struggling with that disease.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, many people come to treatment with a misconception that they're going to run down or somehow mistreated because of the fact that they've become an alcoholic or an addict. Some of this was an outgrowth of the way that treatment used to be delivered years ago. It was very guilt-inducing. It was there was kind of the mistaken philosophy of, you know, as a program, we're going to tear you down and build you back up. And the problem with that is that it just created the opportunity for people to become better liars. You know, they could just say, you know, don't you think? Just they would figure out what to say to get the counselor or the treatment program off their back, but it didn't help affect any real change.
One of the basic steps in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you need to admit that you have a problem. Why do you think that's so important for people to come to terms with the fact that they are an alcoholic?
I believe that the admission of a problem gives you something to fight against. It gives the addicted person something that is an entity that, okay, if I take certain steps to deal with this thing, then I'm doing something tangible, something concrete with my problem. Whereas before, the approach might have been that, okay, there's something wrong with me that I keep making these mistakes. Why can I not stay away from alcohol or drugs? Why can I not experience a day without these incredible urges or these triggers that make me feel strongly that I want to go back to doing what I've been doing? So if it's understandable that I've got this thing that creates this tendency in me, and that there are some specific ways to deal with that, then I've got something to work with. We teach a lot about that allergy concept that Bob was talking about a few minutes ago, that you know, some people have allergies. So what do you do with those? You take a medication, you go get shots, you do things that help prevent your exposure to the allergen. Personally, I'm extremely allergic to cats, so I like cats. They're kind of cool, but I don't go and touch them and pick them up and play with them because I have a huge reaction. Well, it's the same thing with alcohol or drugs for many people. They can't afford to touch them. It causes just a cascading series of bad events in their life.
I want to ask another question, Bob, about some of the terminology in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the phrases that has come out of the 12-step movement is recovering alcoholic. And people use that phrase rather than former alcoholic. Why do you think it's important to use that terminology?
Well, I in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which outlines the program of recovery that worked for Bill and Bob, it mentions in the book, actually, in the beginning, a couple times. In fact, when they wrote the preface to the book, it says, "We are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body." But while I have, I'm 22 years sober, I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, that allergy and that obsession, I still am not cured of alcoholism. So one of the things, and you'll hear people talk about being in recovery or recovering, which I am, one of the things that continues to work for a lot of us, and certainly me, is trying to help others who don't know there's a way out yet. And so in doing that, it seems that I continue to have a reprieve from that thought to drink or that obsession. So that's why you'll hear people talking about being in recovery. But the actual thing that was killing me, that obsession of the mind, I've recovered from that. As long as I continue to do the things that the program talks about, especially the 12th step of helping others, it seems like that thought need not come back again.
Bob, when did you start drinking?
I You know, I shouldn't be alcoholic, Charity. My dad was a terrible chronic alcoholic, and so I think I just made a decision I would never struggle with that like he did, because it was a blight in our home. But I'm like a lot of people, a lot of kids today. I mean, I think of, they talk about young people and drugs and alcohol. I mean, it was a terrible time in my life in adolescence, and just that awkward feeling of high school and kids and friendships and relationships and all of that. And I don't know when I started drinking, but the magic of alcohol, when it made a difference for me, was when I was probably 15 years old.
Do you know when it started to be a problem for you?
I had a lot of fun with it for a long time. I mean, it seemed like it was kind of a magic elixir. We just couldn't wait till the weekends and football games or whatever else, because we were having a lot of fun with it. I'd hang with a group that liked to do what I did, and it seemed like we had a lot of fun for a long time. And that happened and seemed to happen really well into my 20s. I'd say in my early to mid-20s is when it started becoming a problem. Even I would notice it, but actually my wife would start to comment about what was going on with my drinking. So I would say for me, it became a problem in my early to mid-20s.
Can you give me an example of some of the things that your wife would talk to you about?
Well, just the I was a guy that couldn't keep a promise. Once I'd start to drink, I mean, I'd be at work and my friends would say, hey, they're having free hors d'oeuvres at the Marriott. Well, they also served these 22-ounce beers there. And I would tend to get a couple of those in me, and I would call home and tell my wife I was going to be a little bit late, and call home at 11 o'clock and tell her I ran into a friend from high school, and I'd start to make whatever lie it took up so that I could continue to drink. And it started to cause a lot of problems in our home.
Did it cause you problems professionally as well?
You know, that's in my case, that's one of the things that surprises people, people like me. When I ended up, my family did an intervention is what happened to me in my 30s, but I was at the top of my game in my profession. Business-wise, I was a guy that was hitting it out of the park, you might say.
What kinds of problems was it causing you at home?
I think from my wife's standpoint, I was just so inconsistent. Near the end of my drinking, she went to the school my kids attended school at and told them that if I was to show up unannounced, that they shouldn't let me take the children. I was just that unpredictable. You could never tell what state I would be in. I was totally unpredictable. And when I wouldn't drink, I was as nice as a lot of guys sometimes and a hard worker and tried to be a good father and husband. But if I got started drinking, it would be hard to predict what I might do.
Did you hurt anyone?
I think I was loud and angry, sometimes physical, with my children. And I wish it hadn't been that way. I would oftentimes hear about things I did a day later, too. One of the things that happens to some people when they drink like I drank is what's called blackout drinking. And I used to think I passed out. But what had happened is I would literally be drinking somewhere, and the next thing I'd remember, I was at a party across town. Didn't know how I got there or anything else. And in that period of time of lapse, I'm not sure what I did a lot of times.
Your family held an intervention. Tell me what happened.
Yeah, I was starting to have problems myself with the drink, and I didn't like what was happening. I would make promises to myself and couldn't keep them. And be honest with you, the last 2 years of my drinking, it wasn't any fun for me. I couldn't quit starting. That's the sad part. Once I'd start, I was off again. And my wife had threatened me a couple times, and that didn't work. And finally, she just said, you know, if it happens again, that's it. And I stayed sober 2 weeks. It's the longest I'd been sober since I was in my 20s. And I ended up saying to myself, I think, hey, you made it 2 weeks. I thought it would have been harder than this. And I started being kind of tricked into the idea that it was going to be easy. And I started drinking, and my what would be the last time I drank lasted 3 days. I was gone and called my wife 2 days later. And 2 days after that, they did an intervention on me. A friend of mine met me at a grocery store and said, hey, your family and I are over at a treatment center and we'd like to talk to you. And I am grateful. It was the friend that it was, and that I was able to go and be confronted by my family. And they had arranged for me to be in a treatment center. And that was the beginning of the beginning, you might say.
How long were you at the treatment center?
It was a 30-day program, and I really enjoyed it. I was hoping something would happen to get me out of the – I didn't like what was going on with my drinking. I mean, I was frustrated by it. I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. And the treatment center brought some new ideas to me, and like David mentioned, that maybe I wasn't just, you know, a bad guy or whatever else, that I had an illness or a disease, and that helped me an awful lot. And so was there 30 days.
After a lot of people go through treatment, they do attend meetings for Alcoholics Anonymous or other 12-step organizations. What happens at those meetings?
Well, the meetings are all different. In the Des Moines area, we have 150 meetings a week. We're pretty blessed in that way, I think. I was pretty blessed that I got sober in a community that had meetings in place. And there are all types of meetings. There are meetings that are called speaker meetings where a person will get up and maybe for a half an hour or 45 minutes tell what their life used to be like, what happened, and then maybe give some hope about what it's like today. The early AA meetings in the 30s and the 40s, all of the meetings were speaker meetings. And meetings have evolved a little bit into where they're, some of the meetings are open discussion meetings about a topic, or they might focus on one of our 12 steps, or again, still some speaker meetings around town. So lots of different things. The main reason we have meetings today in AA is a place to bring new people who don't yet know there's a way out.
You've been sober for 22 years, but clearly the fact that you were an alcoholic, that you are a recovering alcoholic, is important to you. Why is that an important part of your identity?
I think as much as anything else, in the right setting, I might be able to help somebody who doesn't know there's a way out. I have a breakfast club I go to every Tuesday morning. I was at this morning, and after I feel comfortable in a while in a certain place, I do not mind mentioning that I'm a guy that's had problems with alcohol and that I found a way out for that. And if anybody would like help, I'd be available. I've done that at the church I attend. My doctor knows I'm a recovering alcoholic if he runs into anybody else. And that's the way AA's message was originally carried, was one person to another. It's the way it still works today. And so some of it is just, again, we call it cooperation with the professional community, being a resource to the recovering community, such as the treatment center David directs, and through doctors and other people who come in contact with alcoholics. We have to make ourselves available, and I'm glad to do that.
Is it an important part of staying sober to be honest with people and tell them that you've had trouble with alcohol?
I think where the setting's right. I don't need to mention to the cashier at Hy-Vee that
right.
I'm a recovering alcoholic. But if I like to make people know in a way that I might be helpful to somebody. I'm not proud of the fact that what I did with my life and alcohol and what it did to my family. But I'm excited about the idea of the new life I've been given as a result of a simple program called Alcoholics Anonymous.
Your father was an alcoholic. You were an alcoholic. And I don't want to know too much about your children, but is that something that scared you as a father, that this seemed to be something that ran in the family?
Yeah, you know, I've always paid attention to that. I've got three daughters, and two are in their 30s, and one's in their late 20s. The home I grew up in, my mother was an alcoholic, too. But the four sisters of mine who grew up down the hall from me, none of them are alcoholic. And it seems at this point, none of my daughters are. They all experimented with alcohol, as a lot of, I guess, kids do or will. And fortunately, it doesn't seem at this point that any of them are alcoholic.
Your family was obviously very pivotal for you in helping you recover. Did your wife try to make sure that there wasn't access to alcohol in your home as she supported you through the recovery?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you one of the best things that happened to me. About 2 years before my recovery started, my wife went to a program called Al-Anon. And there she got the support of other people who had lived with family members who had been drinking. And the greatest thing she did was quit trying to help me and quit scolding me and quit waiting up for me. And she let me, as I say, she let me die of alcoholism. And on the other side of that, too, I was very fortunate in that when I started my recovery and decided to make AA the most important thing in my life for the first 9 months, that she was very supportive in that. And I'm always so glad at my AA meetings when the family is encouraging people and we celebrate birthdays and sobriety birthdays. Oftentimes family members will show up as encouragement. And it's a great part for a lot of us that our families support our attendance at AA and as much as anything else, the time we would give to other new people. I've been very fortunate that way, Charity. My family's been always very supportive.
Bob, thank you so much for being willing to share your story. We will continue our conversation about treatment for alcoholism in a moment. My guests are Bob, a member of the 12-Step community, and David Kapton, program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center in Des Moines. If you have a story you'd like to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. If you struggled with alcoholism, what helped you to stop drinking? This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about alcoholism. We've been exploring the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step treatment programs. And now we're going to continue our conversation about other treatment options. My guests today are David Kapton. He's the program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center. And also Bob, a member of the 12-step community, is here with us. David, tell me a little bit about the people that you work with at your treatment center. Who comes to you?
You know, we have people from all walks of life. We have people from all socioeconomic levels. We have everybody who comes to our center kind of shares the commonality of having been adversely affected by alcohol or other drugs. So we treat the gamut. We just have a wide variety of folks that come in. Our particular center focuses on individuals 18 and older, and it's one of the things that struck me about our treatment community. Most of the time, at any given time, you can look at a small group or a community group, and there's probably an age range of early 20s to 50s, late 60s, sometimes even 70s.
Do people come to you because they need help, or are most people referred or even sent to you by others?
You know, it's a combination. People will often come because they know that there's enough of a problem, and yet they've been clued in on that by the people around, the important people around them. So family members are instrumental at encouraging folks to come and at least get an assessment and see what's the level of a problem that they have. Our particular center is not a locked treatment facility, so we don't see a lot of individuals who are brought to us by the court system, although there are programs that do handle that. We generally have people who they're here because things are starting to fall apart and it's they've got pressure from maybe work and certainly from family members and loved ones.
Your program is an abstinence-based program, so that means that if someone comes to you, the idea is to get them to stop drinking entirely.
Yeah, that's correct. We don't approach recovery from the standpoint that, well, you know, at some point if you get your thinking in line or if you get your action behavior sequences in line, then you will someday become a normal drinker again, or that you could safely use alcohol or other drugs. The idea is that once a chemical problem has started to develop issues in your life or problems, those are some hardwired patterns, both at a brain level and from a psychological level, that have to be addressed in both ways.
When someone comes to you, how do you do the assessment? What are the first steps that you take?
Well, when somebody comes to our center, you would sit down with one of our care managers who will go over a kind of a comprehensive assessment of what's going on in your life, both psychosocial, you know, how are things going at work and at home, and mental health needs, as well as usage patterns. Is there the potential that this person will need a medically managed detox program in order to just to get stable enough to be able to benefit from treatment? So we've got just a real comprehensive assessment of what are the immediate needs. Will this person need to enter a hospital bed for a few days? And then recommendations are given as to what's the right level of treatment to get people in. We've got multiple levels of treatment. We've got, like I mentioned, the medically managed detox. We have intensive outpatient, both day and evening programs, and that can go anywhere from 3 to 5 days a week. We've got a short-term residential program, which often people will transition into after having completed a medically managed detox in the hospital setting. Also, one of the good things that we provide and we feel strong about is our aftercare program, which is run by actually volunteer facilitators. So we've got opportunities for individuals after they go through treatment and they've gone through the intensive outpatient and even continuing care, which is a one day a week meeting with one of our counselors in a group setting. Then they can get into aftercare if they like. And then there's several different types of aftercare groups that we have that are sort of theme-based or kinds of people based. Like, for example, there's a nurses aftercare group, and these are run by volunteer facilitators that contribute to PAL in that way. And those meetings go on a weekly basis, and someone could belong to these growth groups is another name for them indefinitely.
Can you help someone if they can't or won't admit that they are an alcoholic?
You know, that's a good question. That kind of brings up the idea, too, and this is a commonly held, I think, misconception that somebody has to hit their absolute rock bottom before they will really benefit from treatment or for getting help. And there's people who, through the process of treatment, they arrive there grudgingly and sometimes kicking and screaming. But as they go through it, they begin to realize that, and they've had some clarity because of perhaps 20, 30 days of sobriety. That, wow, I really have interfered in the lives of people around me, and I'm starting for the first time to see this thing clearly. So I don't subscribe to the notion that somebody has to be absolutely at their very worst before they're going to get some help. And sometimes the best reason to get started with recovery or with treatment is because I've been ruining someone else's life. And I'm not convinced yet that this is a big enough problem for me, but I'm going to explore it because I'm trusting that this has become a big issue for someone close to me.
I think the odds are very good that right now there are people listening who are thinking, I wonder if I really do have a problem with alcohol. You know, people may have been complaining in their lives. Their spouses or other loved ones may have been telling them that they have a problem, but they haven't yet come to terms with that themselves. What kinds of questions do you encourage people to ask themselves to figure out if they need help?
You know, we encourage people to ask themselves, how is this affecting my job? How is it affecting my performance at work? How is it affecting my relationships with others? Am I getting evidence from multiple sources that there's a problem? So even if it's as simple as, wow, you know, you really kind of overdid it the other night, you know, do you remember anything about what you said, or can, you know, and you start hearing things that Bob talked about, the blackout type of drinking. And, you know, when you start getting information from multiple sources that there's a problem, then it's really time to start paying attention.
Now, obviously,
going to say too, just, you know, medical problems too start to crop up. Mm-hmm. I mean, as drinking escalates, there's problems with liver function. There's problems with, what is called neuropathy. If a person has been drinking for a long enough period of time, and some of this is also governed by genetics, is how susceptible is the body to the damaging effects of alcohol? You begin to have problems especially when in withdrawal, when during periods of not drinking, having tingling in your fingertips or extremities. Well, that's nerve damage, so there's a whole host of medical things that can begin to happen because of alcohol.
When someone comes to you, do you need to try to determine whether they are an alcoholic or if they are someone who abuses alcohol? Is there a distinction to be drawn?
You know, for some there is, although I think the thing that's common between a pattern of alcohol abuse and alcoholism is that the presence of alcohol in this person's life has begun to cause problems. And because of genetic predispositions, there are going to be some that more quickly escalate to alcoholism from alcohol abuse than for others. There are some who hit treatment before it goes all the way to alcoholism, and that's a great advantage. And if they truly recognize that, wow, I'm not a normal drinker, and I probably never will be, then they've got a leg up on whether this becomes full alcoholism or not.
In drawing that distinction, are there people who abuse alcohol on a regular basis that don't have to stop drinking entirely to stop abusing alcohol?
I don't believe so, and I think Bob would probably weigh in on this too, is just that if somebody has got a repeated pattern of problems because of drinking, that if they try to fix the problem by somehow controlling the drinking or drinking smarter, and they may have to try that. They may have to see, okay, can I experiment around with this and see if it really is causing me less problems in my life? Chances are that it's not. What do you think?
Yeah, I one of the tests I used to give myself, I would decide that if I just wouldn't drink until the fifth frame of the second game while I was bowling, that I probably was an alcoholic. And every Friday night, I'd start drinking about the fifth frame of the second game, and I would lose control the rest of the night. So I would start to play games in my own mind and you know what? Most normal drinkers don't do that. They don't have to decide, whether they have a problem with it or not. Most normal drinkers, and most people are normal drinkers. 9 out of 10, they think, don't have the reaction to alcohol that I have, that for some reason when I get enough of it inside me, I start to want more. And so, if people are like me and start playing the game about, trying to limit my drinks or whatever else, most normal drinkers don't go through that type of mental process.
So that may be a flag right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in treatment, we like to explain to people that if it has become a problem, then now it's time to look at it and let's see what we can help you do. How can we help you decide what course of action is going to work for you?
Bob was talking about how difficult his drinking was for his wife and for his family. And, clearly there are problems caused for the individual who has the drinking problem. But for those around them, there can be many problems caused as well. With your treatment center, David, what kind of support do you offer to family members who are trying to cope with this?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. We've got an outstanding family program. We have two full nights a week worth of family programming, and this is available to members of people who are in treatment with Powell. And it's actually a 12-week program that if they choose, they can go through that much information getting and participating in lectures and educational sessions and groups and group therapy and just really kind of coming to grips with, boy, this thing has really done something to our family. And then recognizing, too, those patterns of what are known as codependency or enabling patterns that, where a loved one inadvertently has been doing certain things to help support the person's drinking or using, such as some examples of that could be covering up for things that have been let go because of a person's drinking or using, making excuses, trying to control them one way or another. I mean, there's just many complex things related to codependency and enabling. We just have a fabulous staff that does a good personalized job of helping people identify those patterns. And in doing so, creating a network of support right at home that is not going to be conducive to the continuing of this person's alcoholism or addiction.
I have heard people talk about struggling with their alcoholism and having a difficult time overcoming it when alcohol is extremely available to them, when they have a spouse who also drinks, or if they live in a culture where alcohol is available. Is that a real problem for the people that you help, trying to change the place where they live or the kind of culture they participate in?
Yeah, well, what we try to do regarding that issue is, because you're right, it is everywhere. And we encourage people to identify triggers. So if it's a trigger for me to pause when I pass the liquor aisle at the grocery store, then I need to step clear of that or move more quickly past that aisle because I'm recognizing how big of a trigger that is. Why do I want to tempt fate or stick my hand in a fire? You know, those kinds of things. We do a lot of family education about just that is, you know, do you need to look at your own drinking? Do you drink? Is it important for you to continue to have alcohol in the house when your spouse is really struggling to get control of their life? And surprisingly enough, that can be an issue. That can be a real issue for spouses or other significant others to kind of change their lifestyle in order to accommodate to the needs of support that the alcoholic has.
Don is on the line now from Davenport. Hello, Don.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say thanks for this program. I have been a member of Al-Anon for a number of years, and I guess this is kind of more of a shout-out to the friends and family out there. AA is a great program, and I've known a lot of alcoholics over the years who've been sober and work in a great program, and it's really been kind of a motivation for me as well. But to the friends and family out there who think you can control your loved one's drinking, you're kind of in for a lost cause. And through Al-Anon, I've learned that really the only person that I can change is myself. And in that process, of course, sometimes the alcoholics around me can be helped or whatever, but it's not something that I can control. You know, I can't threaten. I when I was with an alcoholic, I mean, I tried all the tricks. I tried threatening. I tried manipulating. All those things, forcing solutions, and that didn't work except just kind of make me more nuts. And I've really, Al-Anon's really helped me kind of get the focus back on myself. And I just wanted to kind of, you know, again, say thanks for this program. And to families and friends out there, there is help, too, and Al-Anon has been a wonderful program. So I guess that's it. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much for your call, Don. And, Bob, Al-Anon is a companion program to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was founded – was it founded by Bill W.'s wife?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. In Iowa, back in, like, 1944 – there were a group of women at a local clubhouse in Iowa that started a little society of getting together, and they called themselves Onala. And 5 years later, Bill Wilson's wife, Lois, would name a group of people getting together as a support, Al-Anon. And there's a lot of confirmation that group in Iowa was probably the first Al-Anon group, although they didn't call themselves that. But, yeah, Al-Anon's a worldwide fellowship now, and I've just seen miraculous recoveries, people, their lives restored to dignity and self-respect and a lot of people helping other people.
We only have a minute left. Bob, for people who are listening right now, what do you want people to know about alcoholism?
Well, again, thanks for inviting me on your program. Really a pleasure to be with you. I'd say to know about alcoholism, 1 in 10 suffer from alcoholism that drink alcohol. Not everybody does. Our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, has been kind of the text for our whole program. And I'd recommend anyone that is concerned if they have a problem or wants to learn more about the problem of alcoholism, the book is laid out in a way that describes it. So I would recommend that book to anyone who thinks they might have a problem or living with someone that might.
All right, Bob, thank you so much for your time today. Bob is a member of the 12-Step community. And David Kaptan, thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Charity.
He's a program manager at Powell Chemical Dependency Center in Des Moines. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and technical support from Sarah McCammon in Des Moines. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, young classical musicians and very, very short stories. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.